Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way, who assesses the damage being done to workers, women's, consumer, environmental, and LGBTQ rights by a record number of Trump-appointed federal judges. Chuck Collins, Program Director with the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and the Common Good, who examines the swing in U.S. public opinion, favoring bold action to address rising economic inequality. And Catherine Smith, Site Manager of the Monastery Shelter in Tucson, Arizona, who talks about the services her agency is offering to the current wave of asylum seekers arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports political prisoners in Saudi Arabia have likely been abused, with evidence coming to light of cuts, bruises, burns, and malnutrition, according to reports prepared for King Salman. Detailed medical reports were given to the Saudi king, with recommendations that are said to include a potential pardon for all prisoners, or at least early release for those with serious health problems. In recent weeks, Saudi officials have come under intense international pressure over charges that female prisoners were subjected to electric shocks and lashings while in custody. King Salman is said to have ordered a review of the decision to arrest and detain about 200 men and women in a crackdown ordered by his heir, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The examination of the health condition of up to 60 prisoners came after the royal family was implicated in the murder of Saudi journalist and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Human Rights Watch called on Saudi Arabia to immediately release all jailed human rights activists and peaceful dissidents and invite international monitors to conduct a comprehensive and transparent investigation into their treatment. The Committee to Protect Journalists asserts that the imprisonment of journalist Fahd El-Sunaidi, who has been detained for no apparent reason, demonstrates the sweeping nature of Mohammed bin Salman's crackdown on press freedom and any commentary that smacks of independent journalism. Eritrean citizens in exile are taking legal action against the European Union for their decision to finance an infrastructure project that will use conscripted forced labor. The Netherlands-based foundation, Human Rights for Eritreans, is calling on the UE to drop its 20 million euro road building project in the East African nation. The construction project would rely on labor from national service conscripts who are often required to serve 20 years or more. The system of compulsory national service for military and civil projects has been described by the United Nations and the European Parliament as mass enslavement. According to the Guardian newspaper, conscripts often work 72-hour weeks in extremely harsh conditions with inadequate food and low pay. This system of severe exploitation is a major cause of mass migration from Eritrea, which has been called the world's fastest emptying country. Many Eritreans have hoped that the end of the country's 20-year Cold War with Ethiopia would prompt a broader political opening inside Eritrea, including ending indefinite national conscription. But since the peace agreement was signed, these changes haven't yet been implemented. As the nation approaches the annual April 15th deadline for sending in tax returns, the average American spends 7 hours preparing their returns and pays $110 to file their tax forms. Major tax software companies like Intuit and H&R Block spend millions of dollars on lobbyists to maintain complicated tax regulations that both frustrate and cost taxpayers time and money. According to In These Times magazine, there are accessible, inexpensive taxpayer alternatives. The state of California created a program called Ready Return, which permitted state residents to review their tax return online, prepared by the State Franchise Tax Board at no cost. Thousands of Californians are using the innovative service. Nations including the Netherlands, Sweden, Estonia, and Japan employ similar systems that make filing taxes easier and cheaper. Intuit, creator of the widely used TurboTax tax filing software, has spent $20 million since 2009 lobbying the federal government to block reform of the current e-filing system. When Ready Return was in development in California, Intuit spent $3 million in that state on lobbying and political campaigns, including $1 million contributed to a state controller candidate who opposed Ready Return. In 2002, tax software companies made a deal with the IRS to place tax software on the IRS website available free to low-income Americans, while also barring the IRS from offering its own free software. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Since Donald Trump was sworn in as America's 45th president in January 2017, the nation's corporate media has been narrowly focused on reporting the president's every tweet, gaffe, vulgar, and irrational comment. At the same time, many Beltway journalists with major outlets have largely devoted their print and cable TV news stories to speculation on the Trump-Russia allegations and the Mueller report. But during his first 27 months in office, Mr. Trump has used the power of the Oval Office to overturn longstanding U.S. policies on a wide range of critical issues, including human rights, nuclear arms control, climate change, immigration, and deregulation of some of the nation's largest corporations in the fossil fuel, pharmaceutical, and banking industries. But by far the most far-reaching legacy of the Trump presidency will be his success working with a Republican majority-controlled Senate in confirming large numbers of extremist right-wing federal judges, many of whom will be serving on the bench for the next 30 years or more. In early April, the group People for the American Way released a report examining the impact of what they describe as narrow-minded elitist judges appointed by President Trump and the damage their rulings have had on workers, consumers, voters, immigrants, women, and many other groups over the past 2 years. Your reporter spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with People for the American Way, who summarizes his group's report titled, Confirmed Judges Confirm Fears, the Continuing Harm Already Done by Confirmed Trump Federal Judges.
Both progressives and right-wingers agree that perhaps the most important part of the Trump presidency so far has been his remaking of the federal judiciary. It was 2 years ago this month that the first of Trump's lifetime federal appointments, Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, began to actually start issuing decisions. So we looked at 2 years' worth of decisions, not just by the two Supreme Court justices, but also by the 37 lifetime federal court of appeals judges on the level just below the Supreme Court, which essentially is the Supreme Court to most Americans because the Supreme Court hears so few cases each year. We looked at over 100 cases involving in which those cases were judges were involved and had very distressing results, finding that already they have done enormous harm to workers, to consumers, to voters, to immigrants, to reproductive rights, and many more. And that's not just according, I want to make clear, to progressives or progressive judges. In many of these cases, there was a dissent or a difference of opinion by a judge appointed by Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush, who felt that the Trump judges were in fact going too far, showing just how extreme they are and continue to be.
Now, I wondered if you would take an example of some of the decisions that have been made by Republican-confirmed judges appointed by Donald Trump.
Sure. You literally can go down the list. At the Supreme Court level, you have decisions where Neil Gorsuch was the deciding vote last year that upheld an Ohio purge of over a million voters, upheld the Trump Muslim immigration ban, reversed a 40-year-old Supreme Court decision that protected workers' rights to organize. This year, he and Kavanaugh have made the difference in cases that could very well have come out the other way if Kennedy was on the Supreme Court, upholding, at least temporarily, the Trump transgender military ban and ordering an execution of a prisoner before anyone could even consider his very serious religious liberty claim. But then go down to that Court of Appeals level I was talking about. The decisions come one right after the next. You have one vote, one decision where a Trump judge voted to allow AutoZone to racially segregate their workplaces. Another one where the Trump judges on the Sixth Circuit all got together and had enough votes between them and other conservative judges to reverse a prior decision and to uphold Ohio's ban on state funding of Planned Parenthood for health care just because with their own funds, they use some funds to provide abortions. Cases where Trump judges have thrown out employment discrimination cases, said that older workers can't bring challenges to maximum experience requirements that tend to exclude older workers. In one case, what the Trump judges and other conservative judges did was so bad in employment discrimination cases that the dissenters accused them of dropping an anvil on the employer side of those very important cases, cases involving the environment. Those are just a few examples.
How can the legislative branch counter some of these rulings by these Trump-appointed federal judges that undermine progress that's been made over many, many years on environmental laws, discrimination regulations, reproductive rights, workers' rights, LGBTQ rights, just to name a few? Is there an opportunity if progressive Democrat, for instance, were to take the presidency and Democrats held the House and Senate, how easy would it be to reverse some of these federal court rulings?
Many of them can be reversed because they relate to interpretations of laws, and Congress, of course, can rewrite those laws. But unfortunately, many of them are constitutional decisions that are hard to reverse, and that's why we are strongly recommending that what people need to do is to contact their senators now, Republican and Democratic, and make clear they should not approve any more of these Trump judges. And when the election comes in 18 months, it's critical that the president and the Republican Senate be held accountable for the votes to put these awful judges on the federal bench.
Well, one last question here, and that would be the credibility of the judicial branch in the United States right now. An increasing number of people now see the judicial branch as a partisan battleground, not a functioning or fair system to mete out just and fair rulings. How much are you concerned, and People for the American Way concerned, with the credibility of the judiciary right now?
I think that's a very legitimate concern. I believe that President Trump has contributed to it very strongly by his continuing to criticize any judge that doesn't fall in line behind his policies. And I do think more and more people are beginning to believe that's true. And as a result of the appointments by President Trump, and to a certain extent by President Bush before him, I think judges do seem to be becoming more partisan. We hope that what we will see in the future after President Trump, and maybe even while he's still there, if people can put enough pressure on the Senate, is the appointment of fair-minded constitutionalists who will take a look at these issues in a fair and appropriate way, not in accord with political ideology.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, senior fellow with People for the American Way. Find a link to download the group's report titled "Confirmed Judges Confirm Fears: The Continuing Harm Already Done by Confirmed Trump Federal Judges" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As some 17 Democrats have announced their intention to run for their party's 2020 presidential nomination,
launch fundraising campaigns, and begun to make stump speeches across key primary states, it's clear that the progressive wing of the party is in the ascendancy. While Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign for the White House was unsuccessful, he garnered wide support for his bold policy prescriptions to address long-standing economic issues, such as his advocacy for a Medicare-for-all universal health care system, free tuition at public colleges, and moving the nation to a $15 hourly federal minimum wage. Many of the announced candidates in the 2020 campaign have embraced Bernie's proposals as their own. President Donald Trump, who will presumably be running for a second term, and many of his Republican Party supporters have revived a line of attack on Democrats popular during the Cold War years, warning the nation that the party of FDR and Barack Obama are scheming to impose a socialist state on capitalist America. During a State of the Union address on February 5th, Trump said, "We are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country, and we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country." Your reporter spoke with Chuck Collins, program director with the Institute for Policy Studies program on inequality and the common good. Here he discusses rising inequality in the U.S., which has inspired, despite the predictable GOP red-baiting campaign, bipartisan support for many progressive initiatives, such as imposing heavier taxes on the nation's wealthiest citizens and corporations, establishing a universal health care system, and forging ahead with a proposed Green New Deal.
Well, one way to think about it is we've kind of lived through pretty much a century of red scares. Whenever anyone has proposed public policies that now we sort of take for granted as part of progress, you know, people, an organized group of people have always said, oh, that's socialism. You can't cross that line. So, you know, 100 years ago, there was a proposal for the income tax and the estate tax, an end to child labor policies, direct election of U.S. senators by voters, not state legislatures. All of those were greeted with, this is Bolshevism. We're moving the United States toward Bolshevism. You know, in our more recent history, when Medicare was proposed, it was considered socialism and socialized medicine, you know, in the 1960s. And here it is again. Some members of Congress are proposing restoring the progressive tax rates that we had under President Dwight Eisenhower. You know, the top tax rates were much higher. And again, people are hollering, oh, this is, you know, going to lead toward, you know, socialism. So it's an attempt to get us to stop thinking and just kind of respond in a reflexive way, as opposed to saying, what is it? How do we really want our society to be organized? And do we have to have these extreme levels of inequality? It's amusing to me that we're hearing the specter of socialism once again, when we're mostly just talking about not having extreme levels of inequality.
Chuck, I've read some recent polls that indicate that there is wide public support for increasing the tax rates on the wealthiest Americans. There's a lot of support out there for free public education. Universal health care, such as Medicare for All, scores high points with most people in these recent polls, as does raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. What do we know about public opinion in terms of support for major structural changes in our economic system here in the U.S.?
Well, I think, Scott, as you say, the first thing is just emphasize again, there's wide support for an agenda that would reduce these structural inequalities. And the fact that we don't have those policies just is a reminder that our political system has been captured by, you know, big money interests, big donors, a couple hundred global corporations. Their voice, their megaphone is considerably bigger. But I think that's a good news, and I believe there's a realignment happening, a kind of pressure building from below of people who are saying these inequalities are not sustainable. We can't have an economy where almost all the benefits of growth and productivity go to a small segment, a small slice at the top, and we would all be better off. And there are fascinating polls when people are asked, how unequal do you think we are? What do you want U.S. society would actually look like. And then you sort of look at that alongside of how unequal we really are. And I think most people don't realize just how concentrated wealth and power has become. And when they learn about that, they feel even more strongly that we should raise the minimum wage, restore tax, progressive taxation, eliminate the scourge of student debt, have universal health insurance. If any of your listeners have those feelings, you're not alone. You're in the majority. Even among Republicans, 60% of Republicans favor significantly higher taxes on the wealthy. So those are not marginal ideas. Those are right down the middle, popular, centrist ideas.
That was Chuck Collins, Program Director with the Institute for Policy Studies Program on Inequality and the Common Good. Find a link to Collins' recent article titled Bring Back Eisenhower's Socialism and other related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Migrant families from Central America and southern Mexico have been arriving in record numbers on the U.S.-Mexico border, fleeing from violence and the impact of climate change on their agricultural communities, where severe and ongoing drought has killed crops and stolen livelihoods. The crush of migrants around El Paso, Texas, led immigration authorities to force those detained to sleep under a bridge with nothing but aluminum space blankets to cover them on frigid nights. Some of those families were later transported by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to a beautiful former monastery in Tucson, Arizona, where they joined hundreds of other families recuperating and getting prepared for the next leg of their journey to sponsors all across the U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spent 9 days in Tucson and south across the border into Nogales, Mexico, speaking to asylum seekers and the people who are supporting them to learn firsthand about a microcosm of the migrant crisis. She walked migrant trails in the desert, visited shelters and communal kitchens, and volunteered for 3 days at the monastery, where she spoke with Catherine Smith, site coordinator of the monastery shelter. The shelter is run by Catholic Community Services of Southern Arizona, after it took over a much smaller operation known as Casa Alidas that was launched in 2014. The monastery was recently purchased by a developer who's currently allowing immigrants to use the space for free, paying all utility bills for the next few months.
So these are all people who are seeking asylum in the U.S., and they're processed by ICE, and they've passed a credible fear interview, which is kind of saying that they have a fear of returning to their home country. And they also are kind of in this lucky group of people that do have a U.S. sponsor. And they're released on humanitarian parole, which is 6 months permission to be in the U.S. And in that 6 months, they will have ICE check-ins where they, is what it sounds like, they check in with ICE. And then from there, they will give them a court date, a hearing, and that's when they'll start their asylum case. And from there, it could be denied right away, or it could go on for months with different hearings with a lawyer and things like that.
This seems incredibly well organized. My understanding is that to go from, you know, a few houses, or I guess there were some hotel rooms too, to this space, you did the whole thing, you set it all up in a couple of days?
Yeah, I was even out of town when we moved in here, but I knew that we had access to this space, you know, a huge, beautiful old monastery, and we were thinking about kind of setting up, you know, for a week and just making sure everything was ready till we would receive people. And then we got notice that, you know, no, there's a large amount of people, and if you don't take them right now, we're going to send them to the streets or to the Greyhound bus station. So in 2 days, they pretty much just set up everything, and the community has just stepped up so much. 99.9% of everyone here is a volunteer, and you see so many people come throughout the day. But it was, yes, a very large undertaking to set everything up.
So tell me, what are the services that people can get while they're here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so right away, after we welcome people and explain to them where they are, we will offer them first, right away, just water and fruit. If they are coming dehydrated, to kind of get some liquids in their system. And then right away, we will start with a medical screening, and that's with nurses and doctors who are here every day. And so we'll do kind of just a check-in to see if there are serious medical issues. If there are, we will take them to the actual doctor's office. And from there, if they do need to go to the hospital, we'll take them to the hospital. So the main thing at first is medical care. And then from there, connecting them with their family members. And so, like I said, a lot of people are coming without money and without phones. And so we'll bridge that gap of communication and help them connect with their families, their sponsors, and then obviously serve 3 meals a day. There's always food available, always coffee. And we'll offer them new clothes. They're donated clothes, but they can pick a new pair of clothes to them, shoes, belts. We'll offer them like shampoo, conditioner, chapstick, lotion, different toiletries like that. Obviously a room. Sometimes they'll be sleeping on a cot in a larger room, but at least a bed and a blanket.
Better than they had under the bridge in El Paso.
Yes. And you can just see people are coming just so tired and not necessarily dirty, but just worn out, you know, wearing the same clothes for weeks on end, just super chapped lips. Yeah, just really wanting a shower. And I think a lot of that is on purpose too. A lot of kind of what we've set up against migrants is this, it's dehumanizing. A lot of this system is dehumanizing. And so for them to maybe, yeah, they're sleeping on a cot here, but from where they're coming from, they can regain that humanity and help us sweep and help us cook in the kitchen and things that help them, you know, feel like a person again, because at home, those are the things that they would be doing.
That was Catherine Smith, site manager of the Monastery Shelter in Tucson, Arizona. Learn more about the Monastery Shelter and other groups providing urgent support to immigrants at the U.S. border by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, D Program Radio in Norwich, Norfolk, United Kingdom, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.